In today's episode, I'm really excited to welcome a true expert in the e-commerce space, Amy Cellino. With over 16 years of experience, Amy's journey is nothing short of remarkable. From pioneering digital strategies at big consumer brands, to steering e-commerce for names like Playtex, Hanes, Nautica, and Wrangler Jeans, she's been at the forefront of the digital evolution. In this episode, Amy shares her rich experiences, including her role in launching the first site for Wrangler Jeans and her successful tenure at MAC Cosmetics. But it's not just her achievements that make her story captivating, it's her insights into the ever-changing digital landscape, her secret sauce for success, and her relentless passion for the digital world. So whether you're a seasoned marketeer, an e-commerce enthusiast, or just curious about the digital world, join us as we unpack Amy's journey, explore her key strategies, insights, and gain valuable lessons from her remarkable career. Let's dive in. Welcome to the Ecom Pulse, your heartbeat to the world of e-commerce. I'm your host, Eitan Kotter. Join us as we meet with industry leaders, marketing experts, and the innovative minds behind the tech that is shaping the e-commerce future. So plug in, gear up, and get ready for a pulse-pounding journey into the heart of e-commerce. Amy, welcome to the show. How are you?
I'm great. Thank you so much for having me.
Looking forward for our episode and our chat today. We have plenty of things to unpack. I mean, you've done so much, both on the venture side, on the brand side. Maybe just for our listeners, if you could give just a quick overview of who you are and about your background.
Sure, happy to. So I am a marketer who's been in the e-commerce space for over 16 years now. I got my MBA deliberately to work on big consumer brands and luckily wound up doing just that. I started as a CPG marketer and transitioned to digital and e-commerce in 2006. So in many ways, I got in on the early side of e-commerce, mm-hmm. but I ran e-commerce for big brands. I did some of Playtex Bra's first forays into digital, ran a business called One Hanes Place, ran Hanes.com, ran Nautica.com. And I was the person that launched the very first site for Wrangler Jeans back in 2009.
Wow.
Did a bit of stuff in the luxury space. I had my own e-commerce and digital marketing consulting business for 5 years that was very successful. Estee Lauder became my biggest client during that time, and they would place me on various brands. I wound up working for MAC Cosmetics, and they brought me on as a permanent employee in 2019. And spent 4+ years there running global e-commerce for MAC Cosmetics. Wound up about a year ago joining a private equity company on their operating platform, leading digital and e-commerce. And now I'm between chapters, so looking for my next opportunity and doing a little consulting for some close friends and family. And that's a little about my background. Yeah.
Amazing. So you've done a lot, obviously. What do you think is your secret sauce? I mean, what makes you so passionate about the industry? Why do you think you've been successful?
So I would say one of the secret sauce, and this is something that I hire for, is a passion for things digital and for how digital works. And I use works, you know, in quotes, in air quotes, because as we all know, the industry changes so rapidly, whether you're talking about Google or Meta platforms, whether you're talking about e-commerce platforms that run a site from a transactional perspective, when you talk about the technology that is required to get all those pieces and parts working for a business, it all changes very, very quickly. So I think part of what makes me successful and one of the things I hire for is that natural, innate curiosity about how things work and how things are changing. And that's important because you have to be naturally inclined to be a constant learner. Otherwise, one of two things happen or both. You get very tired and burnt out by the constant mm-hmm. change. Because I find anyone in this business is really not doing the exact same job every, you know, 6 to 9 to 12 months. It's a different job. You're working on different things. So folks that don't naturally have that level of curiosity and adaptability, or they're going to feel burnt out.
Mm-hmm.
And the people that rise to the top in this business are those that are constantly curious about what the latest is, either from a consumer behavior or technology perspective or both, because those two are always married together in some fashion. So, you know, you have a long day, everyone works a long day, whether any particular day is 8, 10, 12 hour day, 14 hour day, whatever it winds up being. You need the people that at the end of the day, when they finally relax, are looking at their phones and are still intellectually curious about, oh, this is a weird ad format I've never seen before on TikTok, right? That sort of thing. So that's something that I think helps me be successful. And it is something that I look for in as I hire and build teams in this profession.
Yeah. So I think one major theme is obviously the curiosity, right? But also the will and the ability to work hard and, you know, put whatever is required to do the job. Yes. I just read the latest report from Forbes, and according to their research, employees who are switching work like every 2 years, at the end of their career, they're going to probably end up with the double income, like a cumulative double income, than people who are staying in the same company for more than 2 years.
Yes.
Some may say it's even more. Look, a same company can give you a feeling that you are switching companies every day, like every 2 years, if you have been promoted and if you're interested to join different teams or being promoted with more responsibilities. But that curiosity obviously is something that is common and needs to be like at the core of any professional career. And definitely this is what I hear also from all my guests, this common theme of curiosity, and that specifically that e-commerce business and industry is could, like, the amount of changes that are happening on every year is like really overwhelming. So it's really great, right, from one side, but it really requires us to be these continuous learners and educate ourselves on an ongoing basis, which I think is fun and great thing to do. And so, yeah, so thank you for sharing this. What do you see? Let's start maybe from the top, like a bird's eye view of what you see right now when we're heading for 2024. What do you see happening in the industry?
Yeah, so it's really interesting. So I focus a lot on obviously direct to consumer, and most of my career has been with consumer brands. So one of the things that I'm seeing that's very interesting is that companies are or have shifted to profitability instead of acquisition and top line growth.
Mm-hmm.
And the interesting thing is it's across categories. And the other interesting thing is at the same time, some of these same companies are already showing record profitability. So it makes you wonder, what is the end game? What is the goal? Because in many cases, at least speaking mostly for the US at this point, the pressure of inflation is felt by consumers everywhere and is leading to them not necessarily, I wouldn't call it belt tightening, but both consumers and companies being more conservative about their spending than they were certainly during and pre-pandemic. And I think this is, you know, not news to many of us and many of the listeners out there.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it is interesting from the perspective of what do you do as a brand, as a company, to then out-deliver your competitors in terms of value to your consumer base, your customer base, if you're B2B. Because that is probably where the rubber meets the road in terms of success. Because everyone, you know, companies, individuals are evaluating their purchase decisions based on value. And there is this natural tension where companies are trying to make cuts in the right places so that they're still delivering the value, but also driving more and more profit year on year. So it's a really interesting time as a result. What I think this means for professionals like myself in the industry is, and I've talked about this for at least a year, there's a natural shift from focus on acquisition tactics to retention and loyalty type tactics. Mm-hmm. And this has been the case for at least 2 to 3 years, where there's been an increased focus on loyalty programs and how to drive loyalty and LTV. So that's not new information, but there are a lot of new tactics that rely on, and they're not new tactics, they're just smarter tactics, like I should say, that rely on understanding human behavior and psychology as a driver, things like urgency, things like value in terms of number of usage or durability, that companies and brands can talk about in terms of their offering that will resonate more now than they have in years during and pre-pandemic, I think. So it's very much a story of how do you differentiate yourself as a brand and as a business going out there in a competitive environment. And I think for many winning brands and companies, it's because they are delivering value and talking about value in a way that is compelling, resonant, and actually true. Their consumers are actually seeing that value when they purchase.
Yes, I mean, during the pandemic, everything worked, right? You could have extended product line, extended market reach. Acquisition was very, less costly or more effective or efficient, let's say. But now it doesn't work. But we see that comms are improving. We see balance sheets are improving. Profitability parameters are increasing lately. And definitely brands are thinking, as you said, right? What's our unique differentiators? What's our value? What story we bring to the market? So they make them think how to improve parameters across the board, back end and front end. So how do they do that? I mean, what exactly is happening, in real time that, brands are doing actually to improve their performances and parameters?
Yeah, so I think there's a couple things making it actually harder. Like we had the supply chain problems, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Mostly in 21 and 22, we had inflation and price increases across the board that unfortunately some of those price increases are still happening, like in grocery. These things making the trouble of a crowded marketplace in terms of growth and profitability, making it harder. So one of the things that I do as a matter of best practices is get a very good understanding of my competitive set and what are they saying about themselves in the marketplace? Mm-hmm. What are they saying about themselves in their ads and to whom, right? Because there is white space in terms of what different consumer targets, different brands or products have. And if you can understand not only where your competitors are targeting and who is successful and who is not, that's where I think there are gains to be had in terms of, okay, we have this positioning and we just need to shift it a little bit to either be more resonant with our target or fill some white space, even if that white space is, say, at a price point or a particular product line or category versus from a consumer segment or cohort perspective. So these are some of the things that are best practices that I think get easily forgotten when there is internal difficulties like supply chain issues. Mm-hmm. And things that make you focused internally, it's very easy to lose sight of the external marketplace view. And that is, I think, always going back to how your consumer is, or your customer is viewing the market and really doing an objective assessment of what their options are. Sometimes you need an external consultant to help you with this because you're so focused on your own internal mechanisms to bring to market, to your own positioning and marketing as it is today versus what it could be and what others are saying and how the others are shifting their messaging. sometimes an external view is really helpful there. But I think that's one of the, that external view, that competitive assessment view, and that look at the market as your consumer or customer is looking at is invaluable in terms of refining positioning, which I think is the most important thing companies and brands can be doing right now, given things are competitive, given both consumers and customers are really expecting and looking for value today.
Yeah. Well, what are some of the branding practices that you see that, you know, brands are implementing?
There was a lot of talk a couple of years ago about gamification.
Mm-hmm.
And we've all seen this poorly executed. So this is kind of an old example, but I think still resonant. The poor examples are when you go to a site and you see the spin the wheel to get your discount type situation. And if you talk to consumers, they're very annoyed by this because they're like, look, I know I'm going to get the standard 30 or 20 or whatever you're going to give me. Yeah. And you're making me play this dumb game and, you know, extra clicks. And unfortunately, when I've looked at these exercises, when people engage, there is a higher AOV. However, how do you weigh that against the annoyance factor and how much mm-hmm. of that is just, you know, you're so vested at this point, you've done three extra clicks to get your discount yeah. you're going to get anyway. Or is it self-selection where the people that are willing to play this silly game are going to have the higher AOV anyway, right? So obviously I'm in the camp of not playing the silly game. But my point is to say there are very good examples of gamification that relate to loyalty. And I love to talk about Starbucks loyalty program because mm-hmm. they have all of these fun ways that are engaging and drive that level of consistent activity month over month, day over day, that do drive loyalty with the brand and drive incremental purchases. So I think that's probably the best example that comes to mind where a company or brand is doing what I'm talking about in terms of leveraging what is existing psychology. Because you're going in and you're saying, well, what's the game? How am I going to get extra value? Right? Because yeah. it does come down to value at the end of the day. That's the real motivator. How are you able to drive that behavior and give a minimal amount of discount at the same time? And I think yes. Starbucks does a really good job of that.
Yes, yes. Just to wrap up this this subject, again, what I'm hearing and see all over is that brands are like going back to the basics, right? They try to analyze their winning products and winning markets. Reducing SKUs and not trying to win every market that, you know, initially they thought they can win probably 2 years ago. And also on the other side, they are willing to sacrifice their margin and go to promote themselves in with multiple channels like selling on Amazon, now with TikTok Shop and social commerce. And it's the amount of channels that are being added. And sometimes they are losing probably 20-30% of their margin for this channel, but they're happy to do that because of increased competition and the understanding that they need to be where the consumers are. And there are so many communities or channels, right? I mean, just on social media, there is a lot. And you have obviously, we mentioned TikTok and Instagram and, you know, Facebook, but also you have Snap and you have Twitch and YouTube and also the emerging of retail media, which is another big opportunity. And taking into account that we are in a cookie-less world, right? So its targeting is much more complex. And first-party data is obviously can be provided today only by the, you know, the Amazon and Walmarts, I would say. How do you see this this trend, you know, evolving in terms of go-to-market and customer acquisition, which is getting tougher and tougher?
Yeah, so there's a lot in what you just said. So I'll tack them kind of in reverse order. Mm-hmm. The analytics measurement piece of it's really exciting to me, always has been. And I think primarily because the real world is not a laboratory. So you have to tease out what you're looking for and get as close to something you think is going to give you a good read as possible. So when it comes to cookieless and first party, I think companies are just starting, especially big brands are just starting to kick off their first party initiatives and really use that data mm-hmm. in a meaningful way. I think they're relatively slow to do that, which so far has been okay.
Yes, I agree.
The proliferation of ad platforms makes it a little easier to kind of throw things against the wall and see what sticks. There is still that, you know, measurement challenge of how do you measure upper funnel? advertising, which I think is a very interesting and exciting mm-hmm. challenge. People in larger brands and larger businesses are often using MMA, mixed media models to try to tease that out. But those take a long time and you're not getting a frequent read. And you're maybe doing that for one campaign and then using those results for a while.
Can you explain what MMA is?
So it's a rather sophisticated, and I couldn't get into the science of it without looking it up in terms of, is it regression? Is it LLM that actually drives mm-hmm. the engine behind it? But it's a rather sophisticated time-based assessment of these are the various channels and dollars that you're spending, and this is the result and the incrementality. Mm-hmm. They're usually done by rather large firms, rather expensive.
Yeah.
They may take a month or a quarter to complete. And so those results are then, as a result of the amount of time it takes to complete one, those results are often used over mm-hmm. following quarters, mm-hmm. which is fine, except the environment in every quarter, including the peak seasonality, is going to, you know, make that either helpful or not helpful, depending on what part of the year you're in and what you actually measured.
Yeah.
So all of that to say, I think the upper funnel challenge is super interesting and something that I think those of us kind of at the top of our game in the analytics world are going to figure out how to measure appropriately and our brands are going to win as a result. I am very hopeful as a marketer and brand person that the importance of brand comes back into the equation a little more across categories and industries, in that, you know, upper funnel has a place, will earn its place, and that place in marketing budgets will be more understood and more solidified as time goes on. Mm-hmm. You talked a little bit about different channels you can advertise on and offer your product on. As far as advertising, back to basics, you can advertise anywhere. The key question folks should be asking themselves is, where is my target spending their time? And where is my target receptive to receiving these messages about my product or service? Because that is part of that winning formula of where you're advertising. Back to the flip side of your go-to-market strategy in where you're offering your product or service with all the channels that are available today in terms of, you know, you have marketplaces, you have your own branded e-commerce site, you have wholesale. Mm-hmm. I think today the trend is let's be lots of places to drive whatever incrementality and top line we can mm-hmm. without much consideration for brand, without much consideration for being discerning about what places your brand is available and why. It's very easy to say, oh, I'm going to add a site here and I'll bring in incremental 2-5 million from being in this market, but there's also the impact of, okay, if this is a global business, am I cannibalizing existing markets? And what is it costing me to run that site?
Yeah.
Total cost of ownership over time. Is it a smart business decision looking beyond the immediate top line gain that you may have? And when I said, I hope we go back to brand, I hope we go back to brand in terms of brands thinking more carefully and thoughtfully about where am I going to offer my product and why? And it's not just about the incremental dollars. It's more about, am I reaching a new target? Is this retailer aligned with the values of my brand and aligned with how I want folks to see my brand from a price point perspective and assortment perspective? And am I able to fill a unique spot in that retailer's assortment that nobody else can fill to win either physical or digital shelf space? So these are the things that I hope happen. You know, time will tell. Time will tell. It'll be an interesting shift to be a part of and watch at the same time.
Thank you, Amy. This is really fascinating. Really appreciate the detailed response. So GMVs are going up, marketing budgets are still high, but as consumers, do we feel the same?
This is an interesting question. So I've been meaning to write a piece about this, mm-hmm. and I need to write it quickly or the moment will pass. When we are sitting in this place where there's a relative level of uncertainty about the economy and world stability politically, etc. We've got several wars going on. There's a question about what is the driver of, and back to my comment about value. Mm-hmm. What is the driver of value? Because when there is this level of uncertainty and there is a level of inflation that's been baked in, and while there are wage increases that have happened globally, I think we can all say that the inflation, the fact that it's cumulative, and we look at it quarter over quarter, is probably outstripping gains people feel they have for everyone except for the wealthy and super wealthy.
Yeah.
So I think it's very interesting that economists, and if you watch the news or read various publications, they will talk about inflation in two different ways, which don't make sense in terms of how people feel and live their lives. One, they talk about CPE, which excludes food and energy. That's great as far as taking out the volatility, but who do you know that can live a day in their life without paying for food or energy?
Yeah.
That's not how we experience the world, so it's almost useless. The other thing we do in terms of how we speak about inflation is quarter over quarter or month over month. That's also not how it works in terms of reality in your budget. It's cumulative. So I'm feeling the impacts from back 2022, mm-hmm. and the fact that my income hasn't kept pace, and I'm looking at getting less for my dollar, especially places in the US like grocery. So it's a very different feeling than some of the objective statistics would lead you to believe, on top of the global uncertainty that I mentioned earlier. I think these are all factors economically that we're dealing with, as well as, you know, their impact on consumer trends and consumer buying patterns.
Yes. I mean, grocery prices are still increasing. It's not stopping, right? And it's all over the place, not just in the US, but in other parts of the world as well, for obviously many, many reasons. But yeah, this is an area that definitely need to be in close outlook, see what happens. And maybe this point may be a transition to ask you. I mean, you also have the private equity experience as well. So how private equity firms, they are evaluating opportunities?
It's a very interesting business that I hadn't been exposed to before my last role, in that they're in the business of buying businesses and essentially flipping them. And so they're looking for a business that they can improve, and improve over a specific time horizon for a specific variable mm-hmm. on profit. So they may look for 6x or 8x or 10x on profit that they can see versus the valuation. And then in their hold period, they'll look to 2 or 3x the profitability of the business. So they want to be able to see very clearly that the return is there, because they have investors who've given them funds to put in a fund, and they're expecting a return. Now, in that fund, there's a variety of different businesses, but they don't want to have anywhere in that mix a loser or number of losers. So very often, the deal teams are looking for the most certain bet they can make. And as somebody who's part of due diligence is frequently, the variety of complexities that you'd look at a business in a marketplace, there's not a lot of certain bets out there. And with high interest rates, the deal flow across private equity is not rapid by any extent.
Yeah.
But they are looking for a very clear upside over a specific target. So if you're a founder or a company looking for private equity investment, I think the clearest story that you can tell is one where this is the opportunity, but there is not only is the opportunity there and huge, but there is a clear and certain path to that. Which sounds, of course, easy, and there's going to be a lot of questioning, investigation, due diligence done to make that bet as certain as possible. Because that's how those private equity companies, you know, when I was at, considers themselves an alternative investment vehicle, that's how they win in their marketplaces. They're delivering outsized returns. So they're looking for material profitability increases over a time horizon, whether it's 3, 5, 7, 10 years. And they're looking for a doubling or tripling of profit in that time period and a very clear path to get there that is as certain as possible.
Yeah, and in terms of the minimum criteria for the company itself, in terms of profitability, performances like looking backwards, what are the minimum requirements for such a transaction?
Yeah, it really comes down to price, which is funny, right?
Yeah.
There's a price for anything.
Yeah.
They generally, what I've learned is that they don't want to pay, you know, they don't want to pay more than like, you know, a specific X of valuation on earnings. Mm-hmm. So just like selling anything, there's a price at which moves the needle.
Yes.
So it behooves the players in those spaces to find out. You know, it's very easy to believe your own story in terms of this is the time to sell my business. I see the trajectory going up. I see it as a certain bet from my perspective. The private equity company is going to be saying, well, I can pay a certain price for that, but not more. So I think it's important for founders not to get too enamored with their own business and recognize that there's a price at which it's not a value for a private equity company in terms of investing in their fund and getting the return they need to get.
Yeah, sure. Amy, what are some of the success stories that you're proud of in your career?
Oh, gosh. So I'm proud of, I'll mention one that's more of like a hard skill versus a soft skill proud moment. So hard skill, I'm proud of being the only brand at VF Corp to launch a brand site on time and on budget. And that was when I launched Wrangler Jeans. We launched in summer of 2009. And I found out after the fact from one of the presidents that Wrangler Jeans was the only brand that launched on budget and on time. And I remember thinking when I got the news, like, oh, wow, that's super cool. I didn't realize that there's like 11 brands and, you know, my brand was the only one and I was the clear lead on that. I was the first e-commerce hire for Wrangler Jeans. And then I remember thinking, well, I didn't realize there was any other option than to be on time budget, right? Because on my, you know, how I operate, some things are on the menu and some things are off the menu. And being over budget or being late was not on the menu to me at any point in that build. So I'm super proud of that from a hard skills perspective. On the softer side, I would say when I left MAC Cosmetics to join the PE firm for that opportunity, I was pleased, proud, surprised by the number of people across the organization at all levels who said, you were great to work with. I'm going to miss you. You did great things here. You know, because of course, you know, you try not to make enemies everywhere you go. But if I was trying to win a popularity contest, I wouldn't have been as effective and have the track record that I have either. So, you know, maybe this is a matter of kind of learning influencing skills that are effective and don't ruffle feathers or make people laugh as they're heading out of a meeting and leave everyone with a good feeling. I think it was a Maya Angelou quote that said something like, people won't remember what you say, but they'll remember how you made them feel. And so the fact that I left everyone that I worked with at MAC, you know, positive feelings in my wake, I was surprised and very proud of that. I had had teams followed me before, which is a big testament to managerial skills and leadership. Because we've all had that boss or manager we would absolutely never work for again in a million years. So I've been proud of that before, but this was the first time kind of it happened across levels where people were going out of their way to verbalize that to me as I was announcing my departure.
Wow, very, very, very nice. I mean, people want to work with people, right? This is like the foundation of any relationship and everything starts from there, right?
Yeah, and I'm learning it's really mostly about relationships. You're going to work with people that you want to work with.
Yes.
And that's just as important, sometimes even more important than the results. The results absolutely do matter. But sometimes when you have choices, you're willing to make some concessions to have a positive experience and feel good.
Yes.
So that's been an important learning over my course of my career. And maybe we'll see something that I've gotten better at.
And it's only the beginning, Amy.
Let's hope. Let's hope.
Of course. Let's hope. Of course. Hey, I'm really proud of us. It's been like 35 minutes now, and we didn't mention it, the word AI, right? So, whoo! Well done. Well done.
Yes. Hard not to these days. I keep thinking that, and this is a terrible business idea, but I want to have a t-shirt company just so I can come up with the sayings.
Yeah.
One of them would be, talk to me about anything except AI. Because everyone's just almost, you know, as enamored as they may be with the technology, they're also sick of hearing about it, which is really funny. Place to be, but I think we can all relate to that. So
hey, that's an official testament that this podcast is not operated by a bot, right? So we are real people here.
That's right.
Yeah. Okay, great. Amy, this is the fun fact part of the podcast. I know you have a lot of fun facts. Please share with us some few.
Yeah, so I'll share this, you know, something about myself. So, you know, everybody has hobbies and things they really have a passion for, they do for fun. So I'm an equestrian. I ride horses. I've competed, and I still ride on weekends when I can get out of the city. And so you would think that somebody who rides horses would not be afraid of heights, but I'll tell you the story about how I found out I was afraid of heights. I was volunteering for Habitat for Humanity excursion that was part of one of my corporate jobs at Hanes, and we were building a house, and one of the teams that I happened to be on was building the roof. And I realized I was terrified of heights when I was the last person up the ladder and the very first person down the ladder.
Yeah.
And then the entire time I was up there, I was extremely uncomfortable. Skin crawling and not understanding why I was at such a heightened state of anxiety.
Wow.
So that's a fun fact, is that not only do I ride horses, but I also am truly afraid of heights as well.
So you're still afraid of heights, or you already?
I am. I went skiing December of 2022 for the first time, and I went on the chairlift. Like, I did a couple runs, and I think the very first time I was in the chairlift, the way the chairlift swings you up, I think I screamed for like the first minute that we were going up the until I managed to pull myself together and convince myself that I was only going to be in the air for so long before we landed on the other side and I could ski again.
Yeah.
So yes, I am still terrified.
Okay. This is something you need to take care of, by the way. I mean, there are experts who can help you.
Yes, absolutely.
Sure. So again, thank you for sharing. Amy, anything else you want to share?
No, I mean, to everybody out there, you know, having a tough day, just keep going, you know, that's what my bumper sticker has said for the last couple of years. So I extend that message to the world, and I hope everybody's out there still crushing it.
Great. And where people can find you?
Yeah, sure. So LinkedIn is obviously a great place. My email is very easy. It's my first name, last name at gmail.com. So I'd love to hear from people. I love to talk shop.
Yeah.
I love to help problem solve. So happy to meet more folks out there if they want to chat.
Amy Cellino, right? Did I pronounce it right?
Yes.
Great. So obviously on LinkedIn and email. So thank you so much. I really, really enjoyed it. I mean, it was really, really interesting. And thanks a lot for your time and all the value you bring to our listeners.
No, thank you for having me. I appreciate being here.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us on this episode. Your support means the world to us. If today's episode has been insightful for you, consider sharing it with someone who would also benefit. Even one share can make a big difference. Looking to elevate your e-commerce game? Discover Vimi, a multi-channel e-commerce platform that will transform your business with the power of shoppable video. Visit us at vimi.net to learn more. It's Vimi, V-I-M-M-I.net. Thank you for being part of our journey. Stay tuned for more invaluable insights in our next episode.